Welcome back. Talking with Ole and Cody about the Oklahoma City bombing. We've covered a very important aspect of it already, and that was the heroic effort of a black police officer to document the entire crime as much as he could, and there was a lot there. Again, to say it a third time, I'll never forget the initial reports. Being a journalist, I heard these things, Cody, and I said, wait a minute. Officers don't make mistakes. Emergency personnel don't make mistakes. If they saw bombs in there, there were bombs in there. And then we never heard another word about it, and I figured, all right, well, cover up. It's all covered up. It's gone. We'll never hear it again. And we didn't. So, okay, we got a patsy. We got a Ryder truck. We have a seismograph, which I think showed two different detonations, if I remember correctly. How do you go about trying to coordinate the detonation in a truck, allegedly perpetrated by one crew, and then the group in the building, or the group adjacent to the building with the remote-controlled detonations? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jeff. It's logistical. But I just wanted to say something about that cover-up. You know, you were just talking about,
yeah,
there was a massive cover-up, and one of the reasons the Oklahoma City Police Department covered up Randy Yeeke and helped the FBI was because the FBI had been conducting undercover investigations into there were some of the officers inside the Oklahoma City Police Department prior to the bombing that had been dealing drugs, and the FBI had evidence on them. And so when the FBI needed help, covering up this thing and putting out the cover story that McVeigh was a lone bomber, they leaned on the Oklahoma City Police Department, told them, look, if you don't cooperate with us and help us squash down this investigation and make all this stuff go away into a black hole, then we'll indict your people for drug dealing. So it was actually a blackmail thing.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. You know, the tarnished image of the FBI, all I can say from my position is pretty damn well deserved.
Oh, yeah. And so when to get back to the original question, Jeff, about that
coordination,
that coordination, that could be done fairly simply. They probably had some visual person down the road somewhere in one of those bank buildings or the OG&E building, the Oklahoma Gas and Electric building surrounding that. And when McVeigh came, because you can't really tell about traffic, if you're going to have a bomber come up in a truck, he might get stopped by, red light or any number of things. And so he was supposed to be there right around 9, and I think that bomb actually detonated at 9:03 a.m. that day. And there were those two seismographs. Just like you said, that's a great point because it helps with the forensic analysis of uncovering this crime. But when they probably had a visual guy, and he would be on a radio, probably on an encrypted frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would say, okay, here's they're pulling up, and they're fixing to get out, and they could time it that way. Or, there's other ways they could do it, but it was timed pretty close. But the main problem they had is that the two other bombs did not detonate. And now the feds had to go in there and cut and remove those bombs. Plus the main reasons, the real reasons why they actually ordered that bombing up in the first place. It's pretty astounding stuff. Now they had to go in there, not only remove those bombs and hide them from everybody, but they had to get rid of what they originally wanted to destroy in that blast.
That's why we had reports of people carrying a lot of stuff out of the building.
Yes.
I remember.
Yeah. And this is a good stuff. And I can tell you the real reasons why they bombed that building, if you'd like.
I would like, yes. One question first. How dangerous is it to go in there and try to take out two unexploded bombs like that?
Well, that's a good question, too, but it depends on the type of ordnance that's used,
mm-hmm,
and the type of detonators that's used.
They
could be any number of types, but depending on what that is and the types of detonators, then, and also the time factor, you got to remember, they wanted very few people to see those two bombs, so they had to get them out quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, so they probably, if they were used with a standard M7 DuPont electric blasting caps, which is a common EOD tool, they take 3.2 volts to detonate those, so they're set up on a DC supply somewhere, and they probably just cut the two, there's two lead wires that go into them.
Real simple.
And, yeah, they stay shunted normally to prevent RF exposure. That's radio frequency stuff. So when they're operational and are unshunted and they're hooked up to the power source, all you'd have to do is turn the power source off or cut the lines, basically.
Got it. All right. Very good. All right. Why the bombing? Why did they level the building? Why did they try to level the building?
Okay. I have to go back to just a little bit of history so the listeners can understand, because this is very, very important to our country. Okay, so if you go back to January of 1991, that was the Gulf War. And previous to that war, Saddam Hussein, he was a CIA asset, he had been engaged in a war with Iran. And Iran had enjoyed a 10-to-1 infantry advantage, and we were always worried about the Iranians overrunning our asset Saddam.
Uh-huh.
And so we secretly, covertly, in the Reagan administration, we armed Saddam with the Ames strain of anthrax, and that came out of Fort Detrick, Maryland. It had a small protein coat. It had a small spore size. And a different protein coat. It's a weaponized version of anthrax, which would be more readily absorbed. And so we gave them that covertly. And he never used it. And so when he invaded Kuwait, we had to demonize him and stop him. The Saudis were putting a lot of pressure on us. So we went in there in Desert Storm and went to remove him from Kuwait. And our Pentagon, they were all afraid that he would use that AIM strain of anthrax on our own troops.
Oh, yeah.
This, I'm going to try to go through this, and it's just a little background. We'll get to the
This is fascinating.
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so anyway, so they didn't want to admit to the American people they'd given him this stuff. And now that we were going in there, they had to come up with a vaccine of our troops. It's normally a 6-month injection, course of injections where you take one shot per month. And we didn't have time to wait 6 months.
Oh my God. I know where you're going.
They created a new vaccine that went 1 month, and they got BioPort and some of these other companies to make it. They waived FDA approval. They hurried our troops through there. They gave them these shots. The first lot went to Dover Air Force Base. The pilots were all getting sick. This new thing had squalene in it. It's an adjunct. It's an autoimmune booster, very similar to the Therasol, which is a mercury-based thing in flu shots, or the aluminum, yeah.
I remember when squalene was identified as an adjuvant, a booster, and I'd never heard of it before. Now... Wow, this is mind-boggling what you're telling us, Cody. Go ahead,
okay.
Please. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so now they gave this new vaccine to our troops. It was untested, and it led to what was generally called the Gulf War Syndrome. People were getting sick.
Yeah.
Nobody knew why. And then the second thing that happened in that war, that was the very first time our military had ever used depleted uranium weapons in a war. And we expended approximately 200 tons of it, primarily in the A-10 Warthog tank buster jets that use a 30-millimeter chain guns.
Uh-huh.
And they used depleted uranium-238. And then our M1A1 Abrams tanks, which, by the way, Tim McVeigh was a tank commander in Desert Storm. He won a Bronze Star for confirmed kills.
Mm-hmm.
But those M1A1 Abrams tanks had sabot rounds in them. And they had about an 8 or 9 inch rod of depleted uranium-238 inside of them. And they had a very high kinetic energy, about 5,200 feet per second. So when those rounds hit Soviet tanks, they had enough kinetic energy to blow an 11-ton turret just clean off. Saddam was using those T-54 Soviet tanks. So anyway, there was a big explosion. And a brand new thing happened that had never happened in war before. And this depleted uranium cloud, this explosion was forming new compounds like uranium dioxide. And so when these particulates settled down, the micron size of them were 4 millimeters. Now, our standard military mop gear, the filters on them only went down to 10 microns. So our troops began breathing this low-level radioactive particulates, and they went through the filters, and they accumulate in the human body in two basic places, in the thyroid glands and in the ovaries if you're a woman, or the testicles if you're a man.
Oh, my God.
Now, when our troops started coming back from Desert Storm,
mm-hmm.
they were sick from the squalene adjuncts in these new experimental anthrax vaccines, and they were also carrying inside of them low levels of depleted uranium. Now, what do soldiers do when they get back home? You know, they see their wives, and they make love and have children. And what the Pentagon was worried about, this is the first time this ever happened, the semen in the men had radiation in them, and they were being transferred into mm-hmm. the women.
Sure.
They were getting sick. The children were getting sick and mm-hmm. having failure to thrive syndrome is what the Air Force called it. And the Pentagon, Jeff, they didn't know how many generations this sickness was going to be transferred. And so they potentially had on their hand hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars of long-range medical bills. And so a few years after the war, 1994, there was Chris Shays. He was a senator on an Armed Services Committee from Connecticut, Republican, and he was tasked with determining medical culpability for the Gulf War syndrome of all our troops. We had approximately 480 troops in all the branches of service coming back, and a lot of them were sick. And as I know, Jeff, you've heard about that Agent Orange thing, you know,
sure.
from Vietnam.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And the big DuPont settlement. Well,
yep. Yep.
This was something potentially bigger. And so Senator Shays said, we need to determine medical culpability, and we're going to request the FBI to gather all the records of these people so we'll have medical files and we can give them money. Well, guess where the medical files were stored?
Oh, no. Oh, this is sickening. God.
In the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. Now,
wow.
I know that. See? Now, I got one more bombshell here. So let's just think about that for a minute. I mean, think about what's going on here. It's a Pentagon cover-up. The mop gear was defective. Our troops got sick from that depleted uranium.
Cody, that was a nuclear war. They were exposed to radiation. They were radioactively tainted, poisoned. They came back and gave birth to deformed kids, poisoned their wives. The whole families got sick. This is unbelievable.
Yeah, they called it Gulf War Syndrome.
Oh,
they
sure.
Laid it off,
yeah.
They laid it off on Saddam burning. You know, he lit those oil wells in Kuwait on fire and all this other
stuff. Well, we supposedly blew up some of his chem weapons dumps, too. It's all crap. This is a combination of depleted uranium, radioactive weapons, and the squalene as an adjuvant in the vaccine, among other things. So you got a vaccine component, and you got depleted uranium as the other component, and you got hundreds of thousands of sick and dying veterans.
Right. And so when all those medical records went away, okay, in the Murrah building blast.
Yeah.
Now that, okay. So there was a hearing later on in September the 19th of 1996. This was a congressional hearing on Gulf War Syndrome after the Murrah building records had been lost. And at that hearing, the DOD admitted under oath, you know, at the hearing that over 400,000 Gulf War syndrome records of our veterans had, quote, disappeared. So without the records, they
Got
didn't
it.
Give out the money.
Boy.
Meanwhile, our guys were getting sick. Now, you want to hear the second reason why the Murrah building was blown up?
That's bad enough. Go ahead. Jesus.
Yeah, well, that's what happened. That's why they ordered that up. The second one has to do with corruption of Mr. Clinton, Bill Clinton,
mm-hmm.
And Hillary Clinton. And this went back to Centaur Rose and Jade Bridge and Screwworm. They were three multiply nested ops in Arkansas back in 82, 83, 84, 85. And to make a long story short, we were arming the Nicaraguans with a lot of weapons. And Barry Seal was a contract pilot for CIA. He had been in the 20th Special Forces Group back in Fort Benning in 63, took his training, went to Vietnam as a pilot, came back, and accepted, you know, CIA ops in Arkansas. And he was running the MENA airport there with a front company called Rich Mountain Aviation. And so they were all bringing the cocaine back to pay for this. And they were running approximately $100 million a month in coke through there. And my sources told me that Bill Clinton and them were getting about $10 million a month, 10% of the op money. And he later used that money to go run for president. But anyway, there had been a large contingent of law enforcement agencies that had gotten wind of the CIA covert operations there in around MENA, and the Arkansas Bureau of Investigation, the state police, the DEA, the IRS, they were laundering this money through the banks in Little Rock and the Worthington Bank in Atlanta, which was sent overseas to the Caymans at a bank called the BCCI, that's a Bank of Commerce and Credit.
Oh, yeah, BCCI. Oh, I know. I remember that.
Yeah. And so, yeah, all this ties into this stuff all later on. But anyway, to make a long story short, they had a lot of law enforcement records there, okay? And they were all being stored in the FBI office in Little Rock prior to the Murrah building bombing. There was a police detective in Tulsa, where I used to work, named Craig Roberts. And he got a call from an FBI agent who would not give his name. And he told him that all those law enforcement records had just been moved to the Murrah building. And so when it blew up, Jeff, okay, all those records that could have been used to indict Bill and Hillary Clinton, they were all gone. And you remember in July 26th of 1994, that's when the Whitewater investigation began.
Uh-huh.
And then in August of 1994, that's when Ken Starr, you remember him?
Sure do.
He was appointed to as the Whitewater prosecutor to replace that Fisk that Janet Reno had appointed. See, Clinton had got Janet Reno as U.S. attorney. And then they appointed Fisk to help cover all this Whitewater stuff up.
Yeah.
And that's why they put Ken Starr in there, because they knew the investigation had been rigged. So this whole thing gets real deep, and we have a lot of detail in the book that ties all this stuff
together. All right. Let me, first of all, Ken Starr was a disappointment, was he not? He wasn't able to do what everyone hoped he would.
Right.
Now, and then secondly, let's give I want to get the title that we've tried to find. Where is the book available, Cody? I've got to give that information out.
Yeah, I just have to explain, Jeff, this book is different from a lot of books. Most people that write a book, they go to a publisher, they get it published, and then they go out and start doing interviews.
Yeah.
Since this book was about black ops and I was afraid about writing and exposing things, I had to do everything the opposite. I couldn't approach a publisher with this because I was afraid they'd rat me out to the CIA and then they'd shut the whole thing down. So what we have to do is interviews first, the book later. What we have now is CD copies, edit copies, and we're under negotiation with several publishers for the rights to the book. But we do have some available through my website for people who want.
All right,
this
please
book.
Please give that information out now, because I know a lot of people listening. I urge all of you. I'll tell you right now, this is without question one of the most important books of my professional career I have ever come across. And he said this goes deep. This goes as deep as you want it to go. This really exposes the whole horror of the Clintons, the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein. My God, I was on the depleted uranium story very early on, Cody. And now you have made it eminently clear that our young men and women were just tossed to the breeze. No one cared. They didn't care.
Yeah.
God, they were sacrificed. And how many have committed suicide? 20 a day are still committing suicide, I understand, something like that.
Yeah, there's approximately 22 a day, and we work here with veterans, and we don't charge money. We help them with their PTSD and so forth, and so a lot of them are sick and suffering, and the VA just basically, you know, switched it all under the rug, and it's a real sad thing. But I'll give out my
please.
Let's see, I'm gonna give out my email.
Okay,
and people can contact me there. We'll tell them how to get the book there. All right, my email is C-O-D-Y, Cody.
Yeah.
Golden, G-O-L-D-E-N.
Mm-hmm.
Elk, E-L-K.
Mm-hmm.
At yahoo.com.
Got it.
Cody Golden Elk. I'm part Cherokee Indian, and that's my Indian name, is Cody Golden Elk.
That's a great name.
Yeah.
It is. We're going to go through the break here at the bottom of the hour. Thank you, sponsors. This is far too important. We've got to get more and as much as we can in this hour out for everyone. And the more that Cody is able to present this, the safer he gets. Obviously, I don't have to tell you listening that he is really treading on thin ice, super thin ice with this, and taking a great risk. But he's obviously a great American. And all right, I'm going to back up just a little bit. Depleted uranium. I can't tell you how many programs I did on that, trying to find out the wherewithal and how it worked and all the rest of it. We knew that when the rounds with the kinetic rounds hit the tanks or the armor, whatever they were being shot at, we knew that they were actually, when they came out of the barrel of our tanks, they were supposedly burning already. They were that hot. They hit, they impact, they explode into uncountable nanoparticulates, radioactive particulates. They went everywhere. Everybody was breathing it. There was no way to get away from any of it. You were breathing your death when you were over there. That stuff went everywhere. It ended up on the ground in the sand, and whenever the wind blows, it blew it up in the air again. It's still there. It's still polluted. What can these people do who have been contaminated, who are dying right now? They're still radioactive. This stuff doesn't go away. That's not the way it works. I've got one product. This is not a sales pitch. This is a product that I have. It's called Bio Superfood. It was created by Dr. Michael Kuryak, is a Russian scientist after Chernobyl. And he found that by combining the four most potent algaes that he could find on the world surface, on the face of the earth, into one compound, biosuperfood, it actually, not only nutritionally was fabulous, but it chelated the radioactivity out of the bodies of Chernobyl victims at a remarkable rate. And he saved lots and lots of lives with that. So that's one thing. But in that the government would never even admit that these people had been dosed with radioactivity, what could the VA do, even if it wanted to, without assuming liability and exposing the government to full liability for turning our men and women into radioactive sacrifices? This is what they did.
Right. The problem is actually much bigger than that. I've got multiple degrees in mathematics and physics and stuff like that, and I can get pretty technical with all this, but just in layman's terms, one of the secondary part of this was that, as you said, those nanoparticulates, they were deposited in the area wherever these battles were. And then later on, our troops might go through that same area,
right,
on a different operation, and the half tracks on the tanks and the
yep.
choppers would
yep.
stir this dust back up. And these guys, a lot of times, weren't wearing their mop gear, and they're breathing this stuff straight in. And then the other part of it, they had a cover-up with the United Nations, because this stuff was all getting into the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And those rivers were used to irrigate the date crops in Iraq, one of their biggest exports. They have like 20-some-odd, I think it's 26 kinds of dates that they export around the area. Those dates were beginning to pick up this radioactivity. And then about 10 years after the Desert Storm in 91, right around 2001 when the Twin Towers came down, these UN reports came out, and there was a 600% increase in leukemia-type sicknesses in the children in Iraq. So it wasn't just our soldiers. It was the people there and the suffering of those children there. So
it wasn't just overdosed, hyperdosed Fallujah. It was into the ground, into the irrigation water, into the agrarian crop. In this case, it's dates and other crops as well. So we literally destroyed the whole country.
Oh, it's not only that. We had also sold Saddam, and he had acquired from the Russians, I believe, other types of biologicals, like the sarin and the tabin gas. They were stored at the Qamasiya facility in Iraq.
Uh-huh.
And the sarin is a trimethyl ethyl thiocholine-based neurotoxin. And when our forward observer teams and stuff went in there, they were sniffing. They had all their sniffers and their chemical gear on. It turned out that some of the crates in that Qamasiya depot, it's a huge depot, they were actually marked with U.S. markings. And so they wanted to destroy that evidence to cover up that we had given him
supplied
all these covert
him.
Arms. So they detonated that, and they didn't put it out on the radio. It was a covert thing where they just went in and said, look, we got to get rid of this evidence. They detonated all that stuff, and it made a big plume of air. It blew miles.
I remember.
Yeah, our troops that were downstream, they breathed that stuff too. So this whole area, Jeff and Ole, it was just this big toxic soup. And the guys came home, they labeled it Gulf War Syndrome. The records were put in the Murrah Building, and it was detonated, just before the big hearing. So that was the main cover-up. That's the reason the American people haven't been told this stuff. We armed Saddam Hussein covertly. Another way we armed him was with the Hawkeye 123 cluster bombs. CIA copied our patents on those, and they covertly took them down to a place in Argentina, and they hired a front company to begin building them and sending them to Saddam to arm him. And there was a component in them called zirconium. It's one of the key components, and it's on the State Department's banned export list. So they had to fake a bunch of files through the Agriculture Department and get the zirconium out of our mines down there to them too. So that was another covert arms thing that they used. So there was all this covert black ops, shadow government stuff going on that none of our people were told. And that's why I wrote this book, is to try to get the truth out to the American people and our veterans. My father was at Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 41, Guadalcanal and all that. He's actually my stepdad. He wasn't my father. But all our troops and all our guys are suffering while all these politicians get rich off these wars. And the story about what really happened in Benghazi, I have people that were right there on the ground, CIA assets. That's an amazing story. They told me right to my ear. But
would you, Cody, excuse me, I would like you to come back on the program again very soon. And as many times as we need to get what you know out there, this is vital, absolutely vital information that we have a right to, we need to know. And I really honor you for doing this. This is extraordinary.
Yeah. Jeff, I'm sorry I talk so fast. I'm trying to jam a lot of stuff.
No, you're doing just great.
Ole's been silent, and Ole knows a lot more than me about some of this stuff. And
he's a wizard.
He's a wizard, that's for sure. But I really appreciate this time to talk about all.
Well, this is absolutely crucial, what you have shared with us. And thank you, Ole, for just standing there and listening. It must never get to be too much for you. You can't hear this truth too much. You don't get to hear it very often. This just doesn't happen.
No. Can I just point out also, do you know when the first bombs went off at the Oklahoma City, at that Alfred P. Murray building? People came running there trying to help the survivors that were still in the covered in gravel and dust and whatever. And then suddenly somebody screamed, back out, secondary bombs, everybody has to leave the area.
That's
so
right.
Everybody cleared the area, and in came some vans with people in blue overalls that went straight in and just knew exactly what they were looking for, grabbing all of these document cabinets and so on and getting them out, loading them up into the van, took off. These were the files about the Clintons. Took them off in the vans, and then people were allowed back in, trying to save the people surviving. But people were dying in the meantime while they were just there cleaning out the
dying for the Clintons.
Really, dying
for the Clintons again. God, what an old theme, sickening. This is just remarkable. Now, for those of you listening, if you weren't listening all the way through. The Murrah building came down. If you remember, only about half of it came down. The documents that we're talking about were not all destroyed. And what Ole just mentioned is that there was a team ready. They were wearing blue suits, coveralls, apparently. And they went right in. They knew right where they were going, and they got these documents, apparently the Clinton documents, among others. What they did is they stacked this building full of material that had to be destroyed. That's why the Murrah building was targeted. So there's your answer, everybody. And a lot of those documents came from Little Rock, Arkansas. Wow. All right, Cody, let's step back into the narrative here. Go ahead. May I say one thing? I didn't know that in the Iran-Iraq war, I didn't know the Iranians had a 10-to-1 advantage in terms of foot soldiers on the ground. That's an extraordinary advantage, and yet the war was essentially fought to a stalemate. How did Saddam do it if he didn't use the anthrax?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, Jeff. You recall Donald Rumsfeld was the Secretary of Defense at that time.
Yeah.
And he was sent over there, and he met with Saddam. A lot of people don't know that Saddam was a paid asset. He was in the Ba'ath Party previous and had been tried to assassinate Mossadegh, the predecessor, and failed. And then he stayed out of the country a while. And then they finally he got power in the Ba'ath Party. And we were supporting Saddam with satellite information against the Iranian satellite intel.
Uh-huh.
And he gassed the Kurds up there with some stuff to keep them at bay.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all that Muslim and Shiite stuff, fundamentalism going on. It's been feuding for centuries there.
Yeah.
But the Iranians had a much bigger country. They had a much bigger infantry. And we were worried that they would overrun Saddam, and they did have a 10-to-1 advantage. Hence, the Hawkeye 123 cluster bomb—that's the most efficient killing device, non-NBC device, from air to ground to kill large numbers of troops. It spreads out, small projectiles and kills a lot. That's why we secretly made those in that op down there in Argentina. And then later on, we gave him the anthrax from Fort Detrick. And but they had fought that war pretty good, and they had our satellite intelligence, and it kind of went to a stalemate. And so once that was done, Saddam regrouped and built up his military more and got it all ready, and then he decided to go into Kuwait. And that really... The Saudis were worried that if he went from Kuwait into their country, it would highly disrupt all the oil business and the oil markets and OPEC's price scheming and their ceaseless scheming. And so they put a lot of pressure on Bush and all of them to do something about Saddam. And so that's how all that stuff led.
Once again, we're back to the Saudis. And ultimately, the Zionists behind them. It always leads to the same place. Extraordinary material. Absolutely amazing. Saddam Hussein was an asset of ours for decades, I guess, ultimately. Not a stupid man. I wrote one of the first books on AIDS. Published it in 90 or 91. And a friend of mine somehow knew Saddam Hussein. This is a funny little story. And she was going over there, and I said, here, take this book and give it to him. And she took one of my books over. And when she came back, it must have been 6 months later, she said, thank you. I gave him the book. He read it, and he said, tell him nothing about the Americans would surprise me. Because the gist of the book was HIV was a created organism. It was man-made. And that's what it was. He said, nothing about the Americans would surprise me.
Yep. So,
amen to that.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the Gulf War itself. Let me spend just two, 3 minutes on that. We went in there, and from all intents and purposes, or for all intents and purposes, it seemed like it was pretty much a cakewalk. Now, I've heard stories that there was a lot of bribery of Saddam's top general staff to turn them against him and prevent full engagement army to army. Any truth to that, Cody?
I don't have any actual intelligence on that particular thing, but I did talk to some CIA assets that were involved with the looting of the presidential palace there in Baghdad. You know, Jeff, they had a lot of, Saddam had collected a lot of priceless historical things, you know, museum pieces and all, and those were removed and vanished off in the black hole, you know, before Baghdad was hit with that shock and awe thing. So I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. Well, it was one that, I mean, this government's in the habit of flying a lot of money, a lot of places, and that was the word that they paid off some of the top generals. Who knows?
Yeah, and there were some other things going on over Baghdad that I don't know. Some people talk about geoengineering now and the chemtrails where they crisscross the sky and the planes are spraying. But over there in January of 91, we had civilian aircraft fly over Baghdad and stuff. They were spraying a nano-aluminum type of particulate. And what it did was it saturated the atmosphere. It had a slight magnetic electric charge, each particle, and it changed the overall electrical nature of the atmosphere, which made our radar systems on our Hellfire missiles and telemetry systems on the missiles all work more efficiently.
Well, there you go. And if you folks remember all the years we've been talking about chemtrails here, the application of putting metals in the atmosphere up there is enormous. It's a very broad potential to increase and enhance the defense capabilities and offensive capabilities, not to mention mass mind control. I mean, they this stuff up there. They're doing all kinds of different things.
Yeah, and the nano-aluminum, that's another toxin besides the uranium and all the other stuff. And so our guys are all getting sick. And so, anyway, that's the reason they bombed the Murrah building. And then there was a big cover-up with McVeigh later, and he was sent to the 10th Circuit Court up in Denver, and he was sent in front of Judge Richard Mache. And meanwhile, there was me who had operational knowledge of that, and the ATF-DEA had begun an undercover operation in 1997 in Colorado Springs called Operation Stingray. And I had met undercover agent, ATF agent Blake L. Butler. He was at the Waco Branch Davidian compound. He was also at Ruby Ridge. Mm-hmm. He was also supposed to be working at the Murrah building on April 19th, 95 when it was detonated, but called in sick. And so I met Agent Butler in an undercover fashion, and I sold him some legal guns. And then on April 22nd, 1999, 2 days after the Columbine High School shooting, it was the worst shooting in U.S. history, Bill Clinton and Janet Reno came up here, and they were talking on the TV, and I was sitting around with Blake Butler. I did not know they had undercover 4mm cameras, and he asked me what I thought about them. So I made the mistake of blabbing my mouth about all these CIA ops in Arkansas with Bill Clinton, how they were pedophiles. I talked to Kathy O'Brien, the CIA sex slave, blah, 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 and they recorded it all.
Oops.
So, So then they planted me with evidence, okay, and threw me in prison. And the judge that they threw me in front of was Judge Edward Nottingham in the 10th Circuit, and he was nominated to his position by ex-director Central Intelligence George Bush. Now, the United States attorney in the 10th Circuit was none other than Tom Strickland, appointed by Bill Clinton. When Clinton first got into office, he fired every U.S. attorney and put his own guys in there because he knew what they'd been doing in Arkansas with all these drugs and arms. And so he was stacking the justice system. He was the first president to ever do that. And so they ramrodded me through there. And then there was another guy named Kerry James Gagan. And he had taken, he was a CIA asset like me. And he had been given a bunch of C4 plastic explosives to drive from Denver down to some contacts in Trinidad. When he got down there, there were three guys that were Middle Eastern guys, and he saw in English they were plans of the Murrow Building. So he got spooked. He thought he was going to get set up as a patsy, and he drove back to the Secret Service office there in Denver. And he told them that CIA found out about it. They planted his house. They planted him with evidence, and they threw him in there with us. And so I was in there, three cells for McVeigh, with Kerry James Gagan. They had all three of us that had operational knowledge about the Murrow Building right there. Now, meanwhile, Tom Strickland had been in a law firm with Brownstein, Hyatt, and Faber. And turns out Norman Brownstein in Denver, he had once been on the Council of Six. Okay? They were the attorneys for the CIA back in the 70s when Bush was there. So this whole thing starts coming together. Now, they executed Timothy McVeigh on June the 11th, 2001.
Kerry, Cody, he's gone. McVeigh, people still talk. They say, nah, they didn't really kill him. The newswoman said that she saw the sheet still breathing. Did they kill him or not?
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you what I know, and this has never been out in public before. When they took him, I was there that day, they took him out of there. And then he had to sit on death row. They went to the FCI, that's a Federal Correctional Institute in Terre Haute, Indiana, where they had the new death chamber. And so he was there and got executed. Now, about 2 weeks after that, I was in the FDC, the Federal Detention Center in Englewood, Colorado, in Denver. And one of my cellmates was Chris Holsinger. And Chris Holsinger had an attorney. And, named Nathan Chambers. And Nathan Chambers was the last attorney on the McVeigh case. They changed attorneys several times. Well, Nathan Chambers had went to the execution chamber and held Timothy McVeigh's mother's hand on the front row, and they watched him get the shots through the glass.
Right.
Okay. Now, 2 weeks later, I was in the FDC legal visit room, and I walked up and approached Nathan Chambers, and I said, hey, are you McVeigh's attorney? And he said, I was. And I said, well, did you go to that execution? And he said, yeah, I was sitting on the front row holding his mother's hand. And I said, what was it like? And he turned his palm out to me, and he covered his face, and he put his head down, closed his eyes, and he shook his head, no, and he just turned around and walked out of the room. So what he witnessed was evidently something very bad. And like I said, I wasn't there and I did not see it. I've heard stories that, you know, they gave McVeigh sugar water and all this stuff and they didn't really kill him. I don't know. I don't have any actionable intelligence except
that's a very interesting gesture he made. What's your best guess?
Well, my best guess, I was there with him. He was upset, very upset.
Uh-huh.
I don't think he was a civilian attorney, and he'd probably not been in the military, never seen a lot of people killed or anything. And most people who would sit and watch something like that, that's got to be ugly and horrible. Plus, holding the mother's hand while her son got killed
no,
is ugly.
Emotionally way over the top,
So Nathan believed, I think, that he was killed there, so... Mm-hmm. That's all I know. That's all I know about
I wonder
that.
How much they paid Tim McVeigh.
Well, I don't know that. But I will tell you this. When McVeigh got back, a lot of people don't know this. It's all in the book. When he got back from Desert Storm, he was very... he just got back from the war, and so he went to Fort Benning, mm-hmm. and signed up to join the Special Forces. Mm-hmm. And there was over 100 guys in his class, and they gave this standard psychological battery of tests and stuff. And so they were sitting around one day, and the commanders pulled them out, and they took 10 of them. And the CIA approached McVeigh, and they wanted him to use the Special Forces as a front and be an agent for them. And he was to bomb buildings and assassinate and move drugs. And McVeigh was a patriot. And he said, no, I don't want to do that. And he quit the Special Forces. And after that, he went up to Calspan in Buffalo, New York, as a security guard. And during the Desert Storm, when he got his standard shots, now we're back to all the shots and the anthrax shots and the squalene,
yeah.
there was a covert program which was testing implantable microchips that the Pentagon didn't tell anyone. And this test was to test these chips in a real-time battlefield condition. And so McVeigh was given a microchip without his knowledge. And he went over there to Desert Storm, and Lockheed Martin had these satellites. They were the Battle Engagement Area Tracker System, the BEAST system. And they were tasked with observing soldiers and the microchips and how they worked in real-time battlefield conditions with dust and soot and so forth. And so when McVeigh got back, the protein coat on his chip failed, and he got sores on his butt, and he had it removed, and he got angry that the Army had actually done that to him. So he wrote letters to his sister Jennifer, and I have copies of them. Because Jennifer, later on, when he was charged with the bombing of the Murrah building,
yeah.
The FBI took all this stuff. So most people have never seen it, but I got the actual, I don't have the actual ones, but I got copies of the actual letters.
Yeah.
And McVeigh, he complained to his sister that he'd been given.
He was furious. Oh, yeah.
He was furious.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that the CIA had wanted him to use the Special Forces and do all this bad stuff, and he quit it all. So he went to Calspan, and that was a big, big military contractor. They were into microchips. They were in the Redstone Air Force program with telemetry and electronic countermeasure systems and all that stuff. And I think it was there that he was approached with the job, you know, for that.
Uh-huh.
And also what a lot of people don't know about McVeigh, I had a friend named Ron Cole that was at the Branch Davidian compound. And he was a really good friends with David Koresh.
Uh-huh.
And his mother got sick. And he went to Florida to take care of his mother. And the very next day, the shootout at the Branch Davidian compound happened. So Ron flew back. By that time, they'd set up a perimeter. And so all the Branch Davidians that were not in the compound, they were outside watching. They set up tents, and they're watching this every night. And so around the compound at night, there were these black choppers with no markings. They were 204 Hueys, not Black Hawks.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw streaks going down to the roof, and they were the standard tracer rounds. But these civilians didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, we wish we had some night vision. And some guy showed up, and he goes, I've got some night vision from the Army. And so they sat and watched it all, and they asked him what his name was. And he said, I'm Timothy McVeigh. And
I'll
so they watched. They watched them machine gun up that thing at night. And here's why they did it, Jeff and Ole. That's a standard Delta Force tactic. When you're surrounding a building
uh-huh.
and there's insurgents in the building,
uh-huh.
you always deny the higher levels of the floors. Okay, so they have to go down low.
Drive them down, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, and then that you can collapse the perimeter closer to the building.
I got
you. If the snipers are up high on top, they can shoot further.
Mm-hmm.
So you take out the top, and then you collapse the perimeter. And so what happened there was, night after night, they watched this.
Were these machine guns suppressed, silenced?
No. They were probably standard M60s on the side, and every fourth round's a tracer in the belt.
Got it. Okay.
So, they were seeing the standard.
So we didn't hear about any of this, of course, on the outside.
No. This is all covered up because the feds had to conceal the fact, just like the Oklahoma City bombing, just like all the stuff Ole's talking about. It's the same pattern over and over with these ops. So they had murdered most of the Branch Davidians, and they were down on the lower floors. And after 54 days, of that situation, they burned the building down to cover up the crimes.
Yeah, they had killed a lot of them before.
Yeah, and that was the fire that happened on April 19th, 1993. That was 54 dead, 21 children dead. So.
When you come back next time, Cody, I want to go into this a little bit more about the ATF agents, DATF, and went in, a couple of them got shot, and they were, two of them were, what was it? They were involved with Clinton's helicopter or something?
No, they were the bodyguards for Clinton.
His bodyguards, that's it. I knew they were somewhere around Clinton.
And the theory was that they'd seen some of his sex crimes being a bodyguard because they were close to him.
Easy to get rid of them.
Ordered to go over there and be the first ones to go in there, put them in harm's way. See?
Wow. All right, we'll cover this. Let me give everyone Cody's email address. How much is the book, Cody, the few copies you have available? What do they cost?
We're telling people, you know, like $15 for the CD. And it's an edit copy of the book. The final edition will be coming out at some point. But the reason we did it this way, Jeff, was we were trying to get this information out in case something happened to me.
Understood. Well, it's out now, Cody, believe it. And I'm going to try, if you're available tomorrow night, I'm going to try and shift my schedule around. I'd like to get you to come back tomorrow and pick up loose ends and tie this again and together. This is a huge story, and I want to extend to you not only my thanks, but the thanks from God knows how many people listening all around the world right now who really, truly appreciate the risk you've taken and the service that you're giving right now to liberty and all of us who care about freedom. This is a big deal, and I thank you. So let me see if I can get you on tomorrow night, if that works for you.
Yes, sir, and I'd like to thank Ole. He's been a tireless researcher trying, and he's had death threats on him too. And you, Jeff, everyone, we're all working together to try to expose this ugliness, this shadow government stuff, and hopefully stop it to make our world better.
Well, we're doing our best, and that's all we can do. It's a hell of an enemy, I'll tell you that. And you know
it far
better than I ever would, could, or should. Talk to you soon, Cody. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you soon. All right. Cody's email, I guess, I should repeat it again for all of you who might want to get this book, $15. Cody Golden Elk, C-O-D-Y Golden Elk at yahoo.com. Ole, are you still there?
I sure am.
All right. I don't know how to thank you. This is a really a monumental event in terms of disclosure. I've never heard anything more stunning wrapped up into 2 hours. And I just really appreciate you letting me know about this and coming on and being the gentleman that you always are and just letting him talk. There's a bunch more, and I'm going to try and put together some time tomorrow night to maybe have both of you back if you want to get up early again. You're more than welcome. Thank
Listen,
you,
Jeff,
Ole.
Can I?
You certainly can.
Can I just end with a few things? First of all, my website is lightonconspiracies.com. I think it's quite—it's amazing that his book is called "Choosing the Light," and mine is "Light on Conspiracy." Because didn't really come forward in this interview is how he's so strong spiritually, and he's devoting himself to healing. He's devoting himself to redeem all the ugly stuff that he's been involved in, and also. Any income from the book here, when, once it's published, will go into like a healing center and so on. So he's got very pure intentions. But I was one of the speakers at the JFK Assassination Conference last year, and I ended my presentation with a little song that Sangat and I had made, and I sang it to Cody the other night, and I thought if I can just share it with you as well.
Go ahead.
We sat down, Sam and I, for a few evenings, and we really was trying to find something that really stated how we felt about these things, a strong statement, and that hopefully would be something that could be spread around, and also anyone who felt the same that they could join in. So if you're up for it, here it comes. We're so tired of the bullshit, yes we are. We're so tired of the bullshit, yes we are. We're so tired of the bullshit, tired of the bullshit, we're so tired of the bullshit, yes we are. And that is what I stand for. Enough. Well, enough.
That sums it up.
Enough of all of this crap.
Yeah, indeed. Ole, thank you very much. This has been really an historic broadcast, and I'm so grateful for you and for Cody. Thank you. You take care.
My absolute pleasure, Jeff.
All right. Good night. Okay, we're running a little bit late, but thank you, and I'm going to try and get Cody back on here tomorrow night, and let's hold good thoughts for that very brave man, and the more information that gets out there, the safer he is. So, there we go. All right, back with you tomorrow. Take care.